Oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Be seated, please. Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket. Justice Green will be present for the first argument. He's participating in all three cases, but he has a funeral to attend. So he will watch the video for the latter two cases. The three cases are 090544, Jeremy Mullinet versus Patrick Kimbrell, MD, and John Horan, MD, from Bexar County and the 4th Court of Appeals District. 090753, James Durwood Iliff versus Geraldine Trehe Iliff from Hayes County in the 3rd Court of Appeals District. And 090770, City of Houston versus Steve Williams from Harris County in the 14th Court of Appeals District. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side for each of these arguments, and we will take a brief recess between them. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the arguments should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is ready to hear argument in the first cause, 090544, Jeremy Mullinet versus Patrick Kimbrell.
May it please the court, Mr. Breeze will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice. If healthcare providers are going to have the benefit of the designation of responsible third parties, then they have to abide by the same rules as everyone else. The 60-day provision in 33.004E would apply in healthcare liability cases. Those are not my words. Those are the words of Senator Ratliff during the floor debate on House Bill 4. And they clearly and definitively answer the question before this court concerning whether petitioner is entitled to join Drs. Horan and Kimbrell. We are mindful of the fact that the court's objective in this case is to give full effect to the legislative intent as expressed in the statutory language of Chapter 33 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code. Here, the language of Chapter 33 clearly and unambiguously confirms Senator Ratliff's comments concerning that legislative intent.
Before we get there, how do we get jurisdiction on this?
Your Honor, Government Code 22.225C provides that when the justices of a court of appeal disagree on a question of law material to the case, this court has jurisdiction.
So you take it that the concurring opinion by Justice Simmons is in conflict with the majority opinion?
Yes, and primarily we rely on the Leland versus Brandel case, a similar case to this case, and also out of the San Antonio Court of Appeals, and also involving Chapter 74. In that case, as the court is well aware, there was a concurring opinion where Justice Duncan questioned whether 74.351, the expert report requirement, allowed a 30-day extension to be granted if the trial court had found the report to be adequate, but the appellate court deemed that it was deficient. She was clearly skeptical of that, what she termed a radical interpretation of the statute.
It seems to be more of a comment than a disagreement with the analysis and result of the majority opinion.
And yet the court accepted jurisdiction in that case. The court deemed that her comments, although she agreed with the majority opinion's interpretation of the statute, and she did not say that she agreed with what she was questioning as a potential interpretation of the statute, this court deemed that to be a sufficient disagreement to accept jurisdiction. And there's another case, the Travis County versus Pelzel case, where the court accepted jurisdiction based on a concurring opinion. Now, admittedly, in that case, Justice Patterson disagreed with one of the two bases for jurisdiction that the two majority justices had accepted, so there was a pretty clear disagreement there. That's why I say the Leland case is closer in facts to this case. And this court, having accepted jurisdiction in Leland, think it's very analogous to this case, and there is a sufficient basis to say that there's a disagreement between Justice Simmons concurring in this case and the majority opinion for this court to properly accept jurisdiction of the case. Now, it's our position that there is no inherent conflict between Chapter 33 and Chapter 74.
Can I ask you, please, what is your answer to the argument that 74.251 is the more specific provision?
Well, that question only becomes important if there is a conflict. If Chapter 33 is, in fact, a contrary law right. to Chapter 74. So I think the first issue that this court must address is whether there is indeed a conflict between those two provisions. If there is no conflict, then this issue of specificity versus generality.
What about the language of notwithstanding any other law?
Again, that doesn't come into play if Chapter 33 is not another law that is contrary to Chapter 74. And in that regard, a reading of the two statutes, and they must be read in conjunction with each other, shows that there is no true conflict. In other words, 33004 is not a contrary law to 74, and therefore 33.004 can be read and interpreted just based on its own language.
And would your answer be the same or not with regard to the provision in Chapter 74 that says that it trumps other laws in medical liability?
Exactly. That comes into play only if there's a conflict, only if 33 is in fact a contrary law. Now, 74.351, the precise language used in that statute is that an action, quote, action, to, quote, commence a healthcare liability claim must be brought within 2 years. 33.004 doesn't use any of those words. It doesn't refer to commencing an action. It doesn't say the statute of limitations is extended or told. In fact, in Galbraith, a recent decision of this court, the court did not refer to 33.004, and that case involved an interpretation of 33.004 and a statute of repose in Chapter 16 of the code. The court did not refer to 33004 as a tolling or extension statute. Instead, it referred to it as that limitations cannot be raised as a bar. Mm-hmm. And 33004 talks only about joinder. It says that a responsible third party may be joined in a case notwithstanding what would otherwise be a limitations bar if it's done within 60 days. So 74.251 says there's a 2-year statute. 33004 doesn't contradict that.
Well, the doctor would think that an action was commenced against him, wouldn't he?
I agree. Mm-hmm. I agree. The practical effect of 33004 is to commence an action against the responsible third-party doctor. However, it is being commenced in the form of a joinder, or procedurally in the form of a joinder. If the court accepts the proposition that 33004 is not a conflicting statute, then you don't have to address this issue of conflict with Chapter 74, either the notwithstanding other law provision in 251 or a conflict resolution provision in 74.002.
But clearly those two provisions there's some tension there. I mean, the legislature obviously was intending to, in terms of the Tort Reform, Med-Mal Reform Act, to try to strictly limit those Med-Mal cases to a 2-year limitations period. Wouldn't you agree?
I would agree with that, with the caveat that, as Senator Ratliff's statement also indicates, the legislature was intending to permit joinder of responsible third parties
which
in Med-Mal cases.
Right, which has the effect of undercutting the other policy under Chapter 74.
I wouldn't refer to it as undercutting it. I would refer to it as the legislature was setting up a check and balance system in Chapter 33, and part of that check and balance system, as discussed in Justice Simmons concurring, was to permit joinder of the responsible third party if done within 60 days.
But clearly it's within the prerogative of the legislature to both set limitations periods and enact provisions that would somehow abrogate those provisions through some other policy, like in the proportionate responsibility
yes.
statute.
Yes.
Michael, Are you familiar with the what is it, the Flack versus Hanke case out of San Antonio?
No, Your Honor.
Well, it issued this morning.
I've been up
real early looking at all these cases, but it highlights that tension in respect that in that particular case, a plaintiff sues a defendant and makes an arrangement with the defendant because limitations has run on some law firms that were implicated in the deal. And the defendant brought in as third party defendants, responsible third parties, by the agreement between the plaintiff and the defendant. And the plaintiff sued those defendants, even though limitations had run, and then dismissed the original defendant by agreement. Do you think that's what the legislature had in mind, that these kind of agreements could be calculated by parties in order to bring in people to avoid the statute of limitations?
Not really, Your Honor. I don't think the legislature had that in mind. I think, again, the legislature was setting up this check and balance system, which is a delicate check and balance system. And as Justice Simmons' concurring opinion states, the effect of the Court of Appeals decision in this case, and the effect of not allowing joinder of Med-Mal responsible third parties beyond a two-year period is to upset that balance system, but only to upset it in Med-Mal cases, not to upset it.
Interestingly, Justice Simmons authored the opinion that was issued this morning and permitted that to take place. Interestingly.
What if the original defendant in your case were dismissed?
If the original defendant was dismissed?
You just had the joined party. Would that be permissible in your mind?
Yes.
Not a problem at all?
Not a problem at all. Not a problem at all.
I have a factual question. Your client saw Dr. Allen. That was the original defendant. Did he see the other two physicians contemporaneously, or did Dr. Allen consult with them without your client's knowledge? What was the chronology of all that?
Well, the chronology was that the plaintiff saw Dr. Horan in August of 2004. August 31st, 2004 was the earliest date of negligence as to Dr. Horan. Dr. Horan was the football team physician, and then saw Dr. Kimbrell in November of 2004. So those are the operative dates for, in terms of calculating the two-year, what would otherwise be the two-year limitations.
But all three doctors were, all three were seen.
Yes.
Okay, before.
Yes.
Okay.
I would like to mention one thing. 74.251 says there's a two-year statute of limitations. In that same chapter 74, 051, that's the statutory notice provision, where if a prospective plaintiff provides written notice in the form contemplated by the legislature, it buys an additional 75 days. It adds 75 days to the limitations period. 051 says that if that notice is given, limitations will be told for 75 days. Well, if 251 really means 2 years and nothing but 2 years, then there's a conflict with 051, but nobody is suggesting that 051 is not enforceable. 051, in addition to Senator Ratliff's comments, evidences clear legislative intent that the two-year statute in 251 is not absolute, notwithstanding the fact that many cases,
including one of our own,
refer to it as an absolute statute absolute two-year. Mm-hmm. It's really not. Further, there are other exceptions to it as well. Minority, the open courts, when the open courts provision comes into effect, it's not truly an absolute two-year statute of limitations. And 051 clearly indicates that. So the legislature said in 251, two-year statute. Now remember, that dates back to 1975 in 5.82 of the insurance code, and then that was recodified in 1977 in section 10.01 of Article 4590I, and then it's carried forward yet again in 2003 in Chapter 74 I think an argument can be made that the rule of statutory interpretation, then when you're looking at two potentially conflicting statutes, if the court deems that these two statutes are indeed in conflict, the later enacted one prevails. There's an argument that the two-year statute, the notwithstanding any other law, et cetera, language, is the older statute. It dates back to 75 or 77. Admittedly, it was recodified in 03, and they were in the same bill in 03. But there's still an argument that it's the earlier enacted language, and therefore the later enacted, which is Chapter 33, would prevail. If the court deems that there is a conflict, and then it becomes important to look at how do you construe the interplay of these two statutes, that's when legislative intent and legislative history becomes important. Because you're construing two different statutes, not just one statute, but two different statutes. You can't look at Chapter 74 in isolation. You have to look at its interplay with Chapter 33. And in you've got two clear statutes. 74 saying two-year statute, and then the conflict resolution provision. You've got Chapter 33 that says in 002 that says it applies to tort cases. Med-Mal is a tort case. You've got 004E that says you can add a defendant notwithstanding within 60 days notwithstanding a limit what would otherwise be a limitations bar. When you're construing two different statutes on their face, clear and unambiguous, it's important to look at legislative intent, even to cautiously look at it, as this court has said in past decisions. When we look at legislative history, we must cautiously do so. Even a cautious look at Senator Ratliff's comments make it abundantly clear that 33 applies in this case. The question posed by Senator Hinojosa was directly the issue involved in this appeal, and Senator Ratliff's answer was directly that answer. My time is up.
Was there any other discussion? I take it not. In the history of the debates on the statute about this provision, the interplay of these provisions, was there?
The only legislative history that I'm aware of and was before the court is the question and answer between Senator Hinojosa and Senator Ratliff.
Well, there was a discussion in the bill analysis as well, I think, with respect to this that supports your side.
Right.
But you would argue that even putting aside the legislative history, because some of us on the court are not all that enamored of consulting that, but you would say even putting that aside, there's no, just looking at the text, there's no conflict between 33 and 74.
Correct. Correct. If you look at the precise text of both statutes, there's no conflict. And if the court accepts that argument, then all you're looking at is the language of 33, which is clear that it would
without apply. Any need to look at any kind of colloquies on the Senate floor or anything else.
Thank you, Mr. Breeze. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Cooper will present argument for the respondents.
Very briefly, one, there is no jurisdiction for this court to hear this case. Number two, there is a conflict between the two statutes. Justice Medina, with respect to jurisdiction, in the Brandel case, there was a disagreement between Justice Duncan and the majority regarding whether or not the trial court was the one who had to find that the report was deficient, or could the Court of Appeals find it. There was a disagreement in how the statute was to be interpreted. In this case, Justice Simmons did not disagree with the interpretation of the statute. Rather, she just made the comment, the legislature probably ought to address this. That is different from the decision there in Leland versus Brandel. We don't believe there is a disagreement among the justices of the Court of Appeals. There is no disagreement among the Courts of Appeals or with respect to any decision of this court. And as we've said in our brief, we don't believe the court has jurisdiction.
Isn't there at least a holding, if not dicta, in the Moreno case versus Palomino Hernandez that says 33004E would apply in this situation?
Medical malpractice situation, Judge, don't recall that. I will check, though, and if it does, then the question is, if it's a dicta, would it be a holding that would be a conflict among the parties. But let's get back to the merits of this case, and that is there a conflict between 3304 and 74.251? And the answer is, clearly there is. In Chilkowitz, this court said, with respect to 10.01, which was recodified, that it's an absolute two-year statute of limitations with two exceptions. One is the open courts, minors, inherently undiscoverable injuries, such as the Walters versus Cleveland case this court decided last term. Number two was tolling within the statute itself, that is within 4590I or within Chapter 74.
How would you respond to Senator Ratliff's comments, though, that pretty succinctly evidence?
It is very specific. It's just wrong, and it just doesn't reflect what the statute says. For example, and I was trying to think of an example, if the statute says black, and then you get a senator up there that says white, what's the public to do? What's this court to do? And that's exactly what we have in this case. You have a statute that is very, very specific on its face.
But what do you do about the language that specifically says in the joinder statute, even though such joinder would otherwise be barred by limitations? Isn't that very specific?
Well, what it says in cases other than medical malpractice cases, you can join them after the statute of limitations has expired. But with respect to Chapter 74 cases, you have two things that apply. One is 74.002, which says this section controls over any other law to the extent there's any conflict. And then number two is, with respect to conflict resolution, you have 74.251, the notwithstanding any other law. And this court, going back 25 years to 1985 in Hill versus Milani, which had to do with the predecessor of 16.068, the tolling when a person's outside the state. Then we had the Bala versus Maxwell case, where this court was addressing the issue of which controls 16.003 in a wrongful death case, or at that time, 10.01 of 4590I. This court says, notwithstanding any other law means notwithstanding any other law, Chapter 4590I, or in this case, 74, would control.
Well, sometimes, like the case we issued just last week or a week ago, the legislature says it in both statutes, notwithstanding any other law, and they conflict, and we've got to make a decision on what the overall policy is.
Well, but I think perhaps the more accurate analogy is the case you issued 2 weeks ago, and that is the Texas lottery case, where there was the Texas lottery statute in Justice Johnson, and you had the UCC, and you had a conflict resolution provision that was built in to the UCC. And what this court said, majority of a unanimous court, as I recall, said if there is a conflict resolution provision that's built into the statute, it controls. We're not going to look to legislative history. We're not going to look to construction aids. We're not going to look to anything. We're going to look to how the legislature said we are to resolve that conflict. And that statute, that was the First State Bank of McQueen case. The court said, Justice Johnson, we agree with FSB that because the legislature expressly and unambiguously set out the method for resolving conflicts between the UCC and other statutes, it would be improper for us to go outside the language of the statute and use canons of construction, and that's what legislative history is, to resolve this question. Here the legislature two times put in provisions on how to resolve conflicts between Chapter 74 and other statutes.
How do you address the balancing argument that Justice Simmons raised?
With all due respect to Justice Simmons, I don't believe it's a balancing argument. I believe it's just a matter of following what the legislature put in place. As this court has said, I believe it was in the advanced Fitzgerald versus Advanced Spine case, and maybe later in the Entergy case, this court said, we may not agree with what the legislature did. We may have done something different, but that's not...
Don't you agree there's an inherent unfairness in allowing responsible third parties and that the defendant who's brought them in can blame them, and yet the plaintiff is unable at that point
Well, then how would that be any difference, Your Honor, than where the responsible third party that's been designated is the employer who's protected by workers' compensation, plaintiff can't sue him, or the responsible third party who's been designated is a Chinese corporation that is outside the jurisdiction and cannot be brought into Texas and be sued here as well. I mean, you have that same, if you want to call it unfairness or whatever, in other situations, but
yes,
this
sir. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, but this is what the legislature put in place, and they specifically provided that in 2003 that you could sue employers who were protected by the workers' compensation bar.
Why isn't the answer that the legislature can address some unfairness but can't be perfect?
Well, and again, as this court has said on many occasions, the legislature's job is to pass the statutes. We may not agree with what they do or how they do it, but the judicial branch's obligation is to interpret the statutes in the light of the language that's been passed.
And a practical response to this perceived unfairness, I suppose, would be getting in there and quickly doing some discovery, enforcing the designation.
Correct. And in this case, again, this isn't. There's no open courts argument that presents itself. The one of the original treaters was Dr. Horan. Who did, I think, the original surgery. There was wound care performed in 2004 by Dr. Kimbrell. Then there was a re-rupture of the Achilles tendon after that, where they knew there was problems.
Yeah, so you say there was reason to know from the get-go that
there
these
is.
Other two could have been implicated and their conduct might have been off-kilter.
So this is not a case where the plaintiff did not have a reasonable opportunity to bring.
And you think the result would be different if the plaintiff didn't have that?
Well, if you go back to this court's decision last term in the Walters versus Cleveland Regional case, which had to do with retained foreign objects, this court said for statute of limitations, not for statutes of repose, but for statutes of limitations, that the plaintiff under the open courts must have a reasonable opportunity to discover and bring their lawsuit. In this case, that, as I understand, is conceded. The plaintiff did have an opportunity, did know about it, could have brought it, didn't bring it. And then the question is, okay, are we going to ignore what the legislature said and what they passed in 74.02A and 74.251A?
Wouldn't your construction, though, let's say if the plaintiff was not able to determine that, wouldn't it encourage the defendant to wait until the statute had passed to designate that responsible third party? And then, where are you? You know, there's nothing that could be done by the plaintiff. And well, isn't that just fundamentally unfair, because they're going to have no reason to try to disprove their negligence, and so isn't that just going to put the injured party at a huge disadvantage?
With all due respect, Your Honor, I don't believe it does, because I believe one of the things this court talks about with respect to the open courts analysis is the plaintiff has an obligation, if they're going to bring a lawsuit, to go out and find who's injured them and how they were injured. And it's not up to them to wait on the defendants to say, well, actually, there was somebody else who injured you, and you need to be suing them. They have an independent obligation under Texas law to go out and ascertain the cause of their injury, who did it, how they did it, or whatever. So
can't this be cured by a pretrial order?
A pretrial order. And also, Your Honor, we also see frequently where one of the first sets of discovery that's sent to the defendants is, do you contend that the conduct of any other healthcare provider or any other person in the world caused the plaintiff's injuries? That's usually in the first set of discovery that we get.
But can't the trial court set deadlines to say?
Trial court can set deadlines where you have to do this.
And you can't designate a responsible third party after such and such date?
I believe it's subject to being changed by the trial court by pretrial scheduling order, Your Honor.
And it operates most as a disadvantage to those who wait right until the time for the statute to run, because then you could potentially not have the time to discover any other.
Correct. I mean, if a person knows, in this case, Jeremy Mullinet knew that he'd had an Achilles injury. He knew that the surgery had failed and waited 3 years to even attempt to sue the two initial treating physicians in this case. And, you know, I don't believe that that's what the law encourages or what the law should encourage. The law ought to encourage, if you've been injured, you need to go out and find who's injured you, how you were injured, and go ahead and commence the lawsuit.
Counsel, opposing counsel started off by saying these statutes don't conflict. That's his lead positions, I guess.
I could not disagree more, Your Honor. What the legislature has said, and this court in the Chuckowitz case said, is that with respect to 4590I, and now it's Chapter 74, it's a two-year statute of limitations with two exceptions. One is open courts, which is not involved here. Number two is you have the tolling provisions of Chapter 74 that are included as well. Other than that, it's an absolute, and this court used the term absolute in the Chilkowitz case. Also, this court used the term absolute, I believe it was in either the Rankin case or the Walters case, I believe it was. It was an absolute statute of limitations. Now, how is it absolute if you can wait, sue some parties, you can wait 3 or 4 years, and then they designate a responsible third party, and then you can bring them back in? It's like there is no statute of limitations. It totally obliterates the legislative intent expressed by the legislature in passing House Bill 4, particularly Chapter 74.251. In fact, in this court, the Rankin case.
Of course, if we get into legislative intent, if we get into what they said above and beyond the statutory language, well,
Correct. I don't think you get that. But this court in the Rankin case last term said that we've recognized the length of time that the insureds are exposed to potential liability has a bearing on the rates that insurers must charge. And so this court last term has recognized the importance of having an absolute to your limitations. If you have what they argue, that is, you can designate a responsible third party healthcare provider at any time, and then they can be sued within 60 days. The only statute, the only limitations then in Texas on suing healthcare providers is the statute of repose under Pachuca, Galbraith versus Pachuca, which this court has said last term, June of 2010, that with respect to the statute of repose, it's going to control over 3304E, because if you let 3304E control over the statute of repose, and this was architects and engineers, then basically you're doing away with the statute
but
of repose.
It just strikes me that the problem is largely tactical. The plaintiff has not chosen to sue someone until limitations is run. The defendant knows that. The defendant wants to add the person in. It gives him an empty chair argument, which he didn't have before. Maybe it won't do any good, but it's something. Now the plaintiff is trying to counter that by adding him back into the case, take that argument off the table. But it seems to me all of this can be cured by the trial judge if he just sets earlier deadlines and says, you got to add parties by this, you got to name responsible third parties by that, and after this date, we're going to trial.
Right. Well, in advance of the trial, where none of this happens within 60 days of trial. The scheduling order, I agree, Your Honor, would resolve a lot of this, and it's open to the parties to move, the plaintiff to move for the trial court to enter a scheduling order, putting dates well in advance of the trial and well in advance of the statute of limitations if the plaintiff has indeed commenced their case.
Well, frequently cases are filed right up, bumping up on limitations to begin with. So
Some are, Your Honor, without question, but many are commenced within a month of the event happening. So obviously there is a public policy in Texas to encourage people to file their lawsuits timely, file them early while the evidence is fresh. But again, I don't think that necessarily governs this court's decision here today, because I think what governs this court's decision here today is the plain language of the statute.
Because if you want to get into policy arguments, there also seems to be some policy issues with allowing the designation, but then tolling. So
correct.
We really want to address this as a matter of policy.
Well, but if we're talking about the policy in enacting the statute, again, I believe that's a matter for the legislature as opposed to this court. Whether or not this is a statute that should or should not be enacted, that's something the legislature holds hearings on, hears testimony, and makes a decision.
We at least know what Senator Ratliff thought.
We do
know
that
they thought enough of it to designate it in writing.
Correct, but this court has also addressed Senator Ratliff's comments in other contexts, in Ray Collins, in dealing with ex parte communications under 74.052, I believe, the affidavits. The argument was made in that case. Well, Senator Ratliff said on the record that none of the privileges were going to change by the enactment of Section 74. And this court, in the N. Ray Collins case, said, basically, first, we have cautioned that legislative history cannot override a statute's plain meanings. And then the court goes on to say, and they were trying to argue that this court ought to look at Senator Ratliff's.
Does the legislature itself say that we should look or may look at legislative history irrespective of the clarity in the text?
Well, Your Honor, I think you only get to the legislative history.
I'm asking, does the government code say you can look at it irrespective of the textual clarity?
It talks, you go 311.025, I believe, is the statute cited by counsel. Talks about in construing a statute. Now, again, you get to the question of what's construing
a
statute.
Well, you have to construe that part of the statute, too. It says you can look.
Right. What does that mean? Construing doesn't mean if there's, is it subject to more than one interpretation? This court, though, even in cases where 311.025 was referenced, has said repeatedly three things. One is that if the statute is plain on its face, the inquiry stops there.
Except there are cases where the inquiry stops there and yet we cite the colloquy among senators and representatives.
Well, you do, and I think it's sort of to justify why we stopped our inquiry perhaps at that point in time. I don't know. But this court, I mean, repeatedly, I mean, you go to the energy case, you said that. You go in June of 2010, the Gonzalez versus Gilbach case. Courts must first look to the plain and common meaning of the words chosen. If the statutory language is unambiguous, the judge's inquiry is at an end. Second, this court has held repeatedly that we're not going to allow legislative history to override a statute's plain words. The N. Ray Collins case that I just cited for you earlier, the Galbraith case, you said that. And then finally, the third rule, which I think is very critical, is that if the legislature specifically provides a mechanism for resolving conflicts, that mechanism controls and there is no resort to the rules of construction. Justice Johnson's Texas Lottery Commission case 2 weeks ago said that. We don't care. We're not going to look to which statute was enacted first, which was enacted latter.
But Mr. Brees argues plain language, too.
Right.
The plain language, I'm sorry?
Mr. Brees argues plain language cuts in his favor.
Well, I disagree. First, he argues there's no conflict. And how you argue there is no conflict between 3304E and 74.251, which is an absolute two-year statute of limitations, I don't see that. I think there is a tremendous conflict. And then the question is, do the statutes contain their own conflict resolution provisions? And I believe if you go to 74.002A, which says Chapter 74 controls to the extent of any conflict with any other law, and 74.251A, which says notwithstanding any other law, and this court has interpreted that on at least, I believe, three or four other occasions, the conflict resolution is clearly built into the statute.
Further questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Just out of curiosity, why didn't your client add the other two doctors as co-defendants in the original suit?
I cannot address that because I was not trial counsel. I do not know what the thinking was. I do know, Your Honors, that it's easy to say responsible third parties or med mal plaintiffs should know who they're going to sue long before limitations expires, but that's not how it works in the real world. Sometimes clients don't come to you till late. You have to investigate cases. Your discovery is very limited early on in a case. You're not allowed to take depositions of the doctors or the defendants that you've sued until an expert report is served. It just doesn't work that way in the real world. And to cut off a MedMal plaintiff's opportunity to bring in a responsible third party named by a MedMal defendant outside 2 years would upset the apple cart of the check and balance system, as Justice Simmons talked about, and that is an important consideration for this court. Government Code 311.023, which is the provision that allows this court to look at legislative history, also says one factor that may be considered is the consequences of a particular interpretation of the statute. And the consequence of the interpretation by the San Antonio Court of Appeals is to upset this check and balance apple cart.
So well, then, do you agree that if there were time, a scheduling order could fix the problem?
Not necessarily. Again, if the lawsuit is filed, let's say 3 months, 4 months, even 6 months before limitations expired, which is not all that unusual, given the limitations on discovery early on in these cases, even if the court says responsible third parties must be designated within 60 days or 90 days, the plaintiff is not going to have the opportunity to do that, not having all the information in front of him.
Right. But you don't know of any legal impediment to the trial court having such a schedule?
No, none whatsoever. I think the court does have that, or the trial court would have that discretion. Jurisdiction.
Before you get to jurisdiction,
yes.
It sounds like, for purposes of this joinder question, that the plaintiff's ability to recover from these joined health care providers is in the control of the defendant health care provider, rather than under the control of the plaintiff in this limited situation.
That's correct.
What's the risk that that's going to create problems of gamesmanship? What's the risk that the defendant, who's in the case from the beginning, is going to be able to arrange a special deal in order to allow, under these circumstances, additional health care providers to be brought in? You know, maybe limit recovery against me, maybe who knows what the possible scenarios could be. What's the risk there?
I think there is that risk. I think that is what was underlying Justice Simmons's concurring opinion, that if the risk is that the defendant would be allowed to bring in these other parties, point the finger at the empty chair, but the plaintiff would not have the opportunity to, having evaluated the merits of that designation of the responsible third party, to actually bring in that RTP to benefit financially, potentially, from that RTP's responsibility.
And I understand that. I'm talking about a possible different risk, maybe not at issue in this case, where the original defendant, who's looking at down the barrel of the gun, saying, if I'm the only party here, I can arrange a special deal or limitation on recovery for me by joining additional doctors here that then the plaintiff can sue. But if I don't do that, the plaintiff can't sue them because it's past 2 years.
That is a possibility. Frankly, that is a possibility. But I think that the more concerning check and balance that is upset is the one discussed by Justice Simmons in the concurring opinion. The Brandel case on jurisdiction is Justice Duncan did not say that she was interpreting the statute to preclude remand of that case to the trial court to consider the 30-day extension of time. She didn't disagree with the majority opinion. She was just expressing some ruminations about whether the statute could be interpreted that way. And if she had felt that way, she would have dissented. She wouldn't have concurred. And yet this court accepted jurisdiction in that case. There was minimal disagreement, perhaps, between her and the majority. And perhaps in this case it could be said there's minimal disagreement between Justice Simmons and the majority, but there is sufficient disagreement to permit this court to exercise jurisdiction. The lottery case, Texas lottery case, mentioned by Mr. Cooper is distinguishable from this case. Number one, in that case there was a clear conflict between the two statutes. Again, I stand on my point that there is no conflict here. Secondly, the Lottery Act did not have a conflict provision similar to 33002, that is, that it would apply in tort cases, and 33017, which the Court of Appeals relied on, saying 33017 and essentially cancels out 74002. So you had two separate conflict provisions that canceled each other out. Now, 33017 is not directly on point, but it is analogous. It expresses legislature's intent that Chapter 33 should prevail. And further, in the Lottery Commission case, there was no evidence of legislative intent or history that the Lottery Act would prevail, unlike the clear legislative history here. The Galbraith case is also distinguished.
Clear. you got my attention when you said clear legislative history. We have the statement of one legislator, well-regarded, but one legislator. What if the other 30 senators said something, 29 senators said something different or thought something different or had a different reason for it than him?
There is no evidence in the record of that.
But that points out the hazards of relying for legislative intent on the statement of one or few or some individual legislators.
I think that's why this court has said we must cautiously look at legislative history, and as I said before, I think even cautiously looking at it, there is absolutely no doubt in Senator Ratliff's mind, the floor sponsor of House Bill 4, what Chapter 33 meant.
Is there any particular significance to the fact that the Senator Hinojosa moved to have it reduced to writing and it was by unanimous consent in terms of what the others present were thinking about the statements?
I think that is further evidence that Senator Ratliff's statement was consistent with the intent of the entire legislature, or at least the entire Senate.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Breeze. Counsel, the cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.